by any witch magic, but by the efficiency and coordination of the wedding planner. I was pleased to see that all of the black vases were missing too. Carefully, slowly, I opened the window a few inches, admitting a cool breeze off the water along with the sound of gently splashing waves. In the distance, I saw the occasional flash of what New Englanders call heat lightning. It's a harmless summertime phenomenon, and it produced just enough flickering light to help me see what was going on down there near the shoreline. Shannon's bedside clock displayed 11:30. The fire had grown larger, throwing green and gold showers of sparkles into the air. The flames were contained in a large round pit surrounded by stones. Black-clad witches began to appear. One by one, and sometimes two by two, they made their way toward the fire. At first I tried to count them, remembering that extra witch in my vision, but they moved around too much. I guessed there were between 20 and 30 of them, and within the fire glow I saw that a few wore masks or veils, secret witches, like Elliot and Gloria. I picked up the toy telescope again and fiddled with the simple focusing mechanism. Christopher Rich's platinum blonde hair was easy to spot, and River wore the black velvet dress with the red bustier she'd worn on tarot time, so I recognized her right away. The witches joined hands, forming a circle around the fire. They moved in a slow, rhythmic, dance-like pattern, all the while chanting melodic words that had no meaning to me, but gave a peaceful feeling to the scene. Some of the faces were vaguely familiar. Perhaps I'd seen that woman at the market. Maybe that man was a high school classmate. Had I seen that one in church? About half of the crowd seemed relatively young, 20s, 30s maybe. There were some with gray heads among them, too, moving more slowly than the younger ones, but no less enthusiastically. A few stood outside the circle. Therese, a novice witch, was among them. Not yet coven members, I guessed, but trusted neophytes. I watched the seconds tick by on Shannon's digital clock. 11:57, 11:58, 11:59, 12 o'clock. At the moment of midnight, River lifted a white urn from beside the fire pit and moved to where a pentagram had been drawn in the sand. At the same time, Christopher Rich dropped from the line and, still moving in cadence with the others, walked toward the gazebo. He was really going to sit out the scattering of Megan's ashes, just as he'd said he would. What a sore loser. A gray-haired witch, wearing a veiled hat, perhaps needing to rest, slowly limped along behind him. "Don't go there, Chris. Don't sit in the gazebo." A collective, joyful cry of "Blessed be!" went up from the witches gathered around the edges of the pentagram. I turned the telescope back to River, realizing that Megan's ashes had been returned to the earth, then quickly looked back to the gazebo where Chris now sat on the bench, hands folded in his lap, his eyes blank. "Go back now and join the others, Chris. Don't stay in the gazebo." But he stayed. Even without using the telescope, I knew he'd be just as he had in my vision. My phone buzzed, just as a sudden cackling call came from the direction of the aviary. "Better run, Red! Better run!" Chapter 51. The veiled witch was on the first step of the gazebo when she reached toward her hat. I dropped my phone, grabbed the flashlight, ran down the stairway, raced for the door. "Chris, run!" I yelled, and hit 911 on my phone. When I got to the patio, he looked in my direction, still not moving. The woman drew closer to him, tossing the veiled hat to one side. I'd heard that a person could be frozen in fear. Was that happening to Chris? "Run! Run! Run!" came the crow voice from the aviary. The man remained motionless. The woman sat beside him. She raised her right hand and moved it toward his head. Toward his ear. I didn't have to see the hat pin to know it was there. An echoing crow caw came from the opposite direction. Not Poe this time. This new crow appeared as if from thin air. It dove at the woman, claws tearing at her upraised hand and raking her face. Chris still hadn't moved. I ran toward the gazebo. Help! I yelled. Help! The woman slashed at the air with both hands. I knew that the flailing woman was Claudine Bagenstos and that she was no match for the dive-bombing crow. Does she still have the weapon in her hand? Too dark for me to tell. It wasn't too dark for the crow, though. It snatched the hatpin, the jeweled top catching rays from my flashlight, reflecting shattered sparkles of red and gold, and flew into the shadows. Help! I yelled again. I heard the sound of running feet pounding on packed sand as the witches streamed from the beach below and into the gazebo, surrounding the woman who lay moaning on the floor. Is she going to melt now, like the Wicked Witch in the movie? I hurried to Chris's side. River was already there. Chris, I said, shaking his arm. Can you hear me? Are you all right? He blinked a couple of times and looked around. Sirens sounded in the distance. It's okay, I said. The police will be here in a minute. At the sound of the sirens, the mention of the police, the masked and veiled witches hurried away. The others stayed, looking down at Claudine Bagenstos, some murmuring words I didn't understand, others silent. Lee, River whispered, what should I do about this? She pulled the spellbook from her pocket. I looked back toward the beach, to where the fire still glowed, to where the approaching tide lapped at the edges of the pentagram etched in the sand. A large crow now circled the space where moments ago the covens had gathered. Come on, I said. I'll go with you. Hurry! We ran, then, toward the ocean. River stepped to the center of the pentagram, holding the book high above her head. The crow swooped down, grasped it in yellow talons, and disappeared in a blinding flash of light. When I opened my eyes, I thought for a moment I was seeing double. River, her arms at her sides, stood facing another woman. Each of them wore a long black dress. Each wore a red corset. The woman, with the spellbook tucked under one arm, smiled and held up her hand. River did the same. They touched palms. Another flash, and Bridget Bishop disappeared. River and I returned to the gazebo, where no one there seemed to have noticed that we'd ever left. There was no mention of the flashes of light, of the circling crow, while Christopher Rich, standing erect and smiling, accepted congratulations on overpowering the hatpin-wielding woman who now lay prostrate at his feet. The jeweled hatpin, a good 10 inches long, lay sparkling on the seat, where moments earlier Rich had sat, frozen, immobilized. A wordless look passed between River and me. Somehow, during the few minutes we'd spent on the beach, there had been a shift in realities. I knew that a crow had overcome Claudine, had flown away with the hatpin she'd been about to shove into Christopher Rich's brain while he sat on the gazebo bench unable to move. Yet now the hatpin rested on the seat. Claudine lay on the floor of the gazebo, her face unmarked by razor-sharp talons. And Christopher Rich stood, enjoying the praise of his fellow witches who'd apparently all witnessed him bravely overcoming a crazed would-be assassin. The police arrived. An officer helped Claudine to her feet, and she shook his arm away. Another officer read her her rights from a Miranda card. You have the right to remain silent. You have the right to an attorney. Claudine ignored her rights, especially the one about remaining silent. Witches, she muttered. Witches! I hate them all! She laughed, a short, unfunny, strangled sound.
I didn't even know they were witches until I saw it on television. I killed them because they were lovers. Can you believe it? Elliot chose that sleazy waitress over me. He even gave her my favorite little oil painting, carried it out of the house in a paper bag and drove it straight to her place. Didn't even catch on that I was following him. Stupid man. Did you know he bought that house for her? Claudine shook her head. I suppose I own it now. She laughed. I sent Sean over to buy my painting back, but he messed up. She put her hands behind her, accepting the handcuffs as easily as if they were gold bracelets. She tilted her head toward Christopher Rich. I decided to shoot him. People were starting to talk about somebody killing the witches in Salem. What a great idea! Just kill one or two more witches, and nobody would ever connect Elliot and that tramp Gloria to me. Again, the strangled-sounding laugh. But he was the only witch I knew about, for sure. He's on TV bragging about it all the time. So he had to be next. She bobbed her head in River's direction. I even called you up and told you I was going to kill him, you stupid girl. She looked down at the ground, almost apologetically. But I missed with the gun. Had to go back to my great-grandmother's hat pin. I heard Pete's voice before I saw him. He and Sean Madigan rounded the corner of the house. Pete walked to where River and I stood. Cop voice,
"You girls okay?"
We both nodded. "We're okay," I said.
"Good. I'll talk to you later."
He touched my hand, then climbed the steps to the gazebo and spoke in low tones to the officer. Claudine Bagenstos hadn't stopped talking. "Is the dog all right? I'm sorry I stuck him, but he bit my knee when I kicked him." Sean spoke to Claudine in a soft, friendly tone.
"Zeus is fine. How come you swiped my car again?"
he asked.
"And how did you get out of the house without me seeing you?"
"You don't know all my secrets." She spoke in a little girl, coquettish voice. "There's a nice escape tunnel under my house that I haven't shown you yet. Elliot built it. Be a good boy, and I'll show you later." Claudine was taken away in one of the police cars. Pete took statements from the remaining witches. The WICH-TV mobile unit arrived, and Christopher Rich got more television FaceTime than even he could have dreamed of. Every witness told the same story. The heavily veiled woman, Claudine Bagenstos, had approached Christopher Rich, who was sitting in the gazebo observing a Wiccan funeral ceremony. She'd threatened him with a weapon of some kind, and Rich had quickly, bravely subdued and disarmed her. Not a single one of the witnesses recalled seeing a crow dive-bombing the woman while she tried vainly to shield her face from clawing talons. No one heard Poe telling me and Chris to run. No one saw the brilliant bursts of light, or the circling crow, or the two identically dressed women facing one another on the beach. Nobody mentioned Bridget Bishop's spellbook. Not that night, or any other time. It was as though it had never existed. But it had. Epilogue. Claudine just kept right on talking, in spite of her high-priced lawyer's advice. Like a courtroom scene in an old Perry Mason episode, she talked to anyone who'd listen to her. She freely admitted to killing both Elliot and Gloria. She'd become suspicious about the increasing frequency of Elliot's after-hours business meetings and simply began following him. The path had quickly led to the little house on Southwick Street and Gloria Tasker. The decision to kill both of them had come just as quickly. The hatpin as weapon idea came, oddly enough, from her great-grandmother's reminiscences about her suffragette days. Society was transitioning back then, however slowly, from expecting and advocating female dependence on men to recognizing their ability to defend themselves. A foot-long hatpin plunged into a predator's arm or eye turned out to be a popular deterrent to mashers. Forcefully pushed into an ear, her great-grandmother had cautioned little Claudine,
A hatpin would likely cause death. Gloria's habit of taking pre-dawn bike rides was perfect for Claudine's plan. She'd meant to simply run the woman over with Elliot's car. The hatpin was to provide insurance that Gloria was actually dead. "She made it easy for me," Claudine told a Boston reporter in the corridor of the Essex County Courthouse. "She ran into that post and splattered her brains all over. She was probably already dead, but I stuck her anyway." Elliot's death was quite different. The story about the Apple Blossom branch was partly true, except for the fact that it had been Claudine's idea for Elliot to climb up and cut a certain hard-to-reach bough while she steadied the ladder. "I yanked it out from under him," she told Scott Palmer in answer to his shouted question as she walked the gauntlet of reporters on the courthouse steps. "The hatpin still had Gloria's dried blood on it. I showed it to him before I stuck him." Then she'd laughed her silvery laugh. The paintings have been returned to their rightful owners. The case against Claudine is still ongoing, complicated by the Slayer Law, which prohibits inheritance for a person who murdered someone from whom he or she stands to inherit, by Claudine's penchant for self-incrimination, and by questions about her competence. Both the Baginstose mansion and Gloria's little house stand empty, but both of their fruit trees are blossoming once again. The twin Cadillacs are still in the garage. The Toyota is not. Sean said that Claudine was in the habit of borrowing his car to go to yard sales and flea markets because her black caddy made vendors mark the prices up, so he'd given her a set of keys. He was sure she'd borrowed it for other reasons, too, like for an attempted U-Haul break-in. He hadn't known about the secret tunnel that had allowed her to get away with his car to follow Chris Rich on that fateful midsummer night. Pete had been on his way to the Dumas house even before I dialed 911. The police lab's report on the voice pattern from River's mystery call had just come in, identifying the caller as Claudine. He'd tried to call me, to warn me, but by then my phone was on the floor of Shannon's bedroom, and I was in the gazebo, watching a crow attack a murderer. Christopher Rich is more famous than ever, and has written a tell-all book about the case, since he was one of Claudine's intended victims, and was also the apparent hero of the story. The crows disappeared that night, just as Megan had predicted. The scientists who study such things are still debating the cause of Salem's murder of crows. Theories range from the bird's pursuit of a particularly rare migrating grasshopper to the proliferation of cell towers interfering with their natural guidance systems. Shannon and Dakota are obviously supremely happy together. Dakota's fund for repairing damaged headstones is growing nicely and made a perfect topic for my second appearance as WICH-TV's investigative reporter. Sean Madigan has accepted a position at a prestigious museum as an art instructor and as an expert authenticator of old paintings. Pete convinced Bertha Barnes that photographing people without permission violates their right to privacy, so she has given up that hobby and now only photographs dogs and cats. My relationship with Pete continues to develop in so many wonderful ways. Lately, we've been double-dating occasionally with River and Buck Covington, whose relationship is still in the getting-to-know-you stage. Aunt Ibby and Mr. Pennington continue trading lines from old movies. Rumors are flying about the station needing another field reporter, and Mr. Doan has hinted that my name is being mentioned. That was the job I applied for at WICH-TV in the first place. Wouldn't that be something? We haven't seen the little black cat for quite a while. I like to believe she's playing in the green fields of Summerland. Orion watched for her from his windowsill for many nights, and I think he still misses her. This concludes It Takes a Coven by Carol J. Perry. Narrated by C.S.E. Cooney. Copyright 2018 by Carol J. Perry. This unabridged audiobook is published by arrangement with Kensington Publishing Corporation and was produced in the year 2018 by Tantor Media Incorporated, a division of Recorded Books, which holds the copyright thereto. Please visit Tantor.com for more information on our growing library of unabridged audiobooks.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.